Actor Leslie Nielsen died yesterday at the age of 84. We're going to listen back to an interview with him. Nielsen started a new comedic phase of his career in 1980 with his role as the doctor in the disaster film parody Airplane.
You'd better tell the captain we've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now. Tell the captain I must speak to him.
Airplane was followed with starring roles in other film parodies, like the series of cop movie parodies The Naked Gun and the horror movie parodies Scary Movie, in which he played the President of the U.S. Earlier, he was in over 60 films playing a lot of straight-laced characters. In the real disaster film, The Poseidon Adventure, he played the ocean liner captain. His straight delivery was a plus for his role in Airplane.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Well, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying, altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Besides, I haven't touched any kind of plane in 6 years.
Mr. Stryker, I know nothing about flying. There's one thing I do know. You're the only one on this plane who can possibly fly it. You're the only chance we've got.
I spoke with Leslie Nielsen in 1993 after the publication of his book, The Naked Truth, in which he told a totally made-up version of his life. Here's an excerpt of his audio version of the book.
I'm an extremely fortunate person. I've been honored by my colleagues with four Academy Award nominations. I've twice been named Best Actor. I've won two People's Choice Awards, a Golden Globe, a Best in Show at Westminster, an American League batting title. I've been a three-time finalist in the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. I was named Mr. Week of April 23rd on Home Shopping Network. And finally, in August 1990... I received the highest honor any actor could be given, other than participation in gross receipts. I was awarded the coveted Nobel Prize for Good Acting.
You've become famous for lampooning square, mediocre actors in B-movie formulas.
Yeah, well, it's not really becoming famous for lampooning those kind of actors. I'm really lampooning myself, and I'm pretty square. And I'm pretty dumb, and I'm pretty stupid, too.
Well, this all started for you with Airplane. How were you chosen as one of the actors in Airplane?
I think that David and Jerry Zucker and Jim Abrams, who were the authors and the creators, directors, etc. of Airplane, they had written something that was just wonderfully dumb and funny. And they knew that if Peter Graves and Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack and myself, they had seen our work on television, and if we approached their material with the same seriousness and the same gravity with which we approached our police work television show that we were doing, that it would be very funny. And when I read the script, I knew exactly what they were after, and it was the greatest, advent or break of my life in a sense, but I ended up working with people who spotted me for being the closet comedian that I was. And from there came Police Squad and Naked Gun, and it was the launching of the nut that is inside of Nielsen. Thank God for it.
How did you do the condom scene in Naked Gun?
Very gently. You know what happened with that scene was that in the beginning we had a material on the condom that you could, really kind of see through. And the scene didn't work. It just didn't. It was not funny. And eventually David figured it out, and he had them remake the condom, but so that you could see the outline, but you could not see anybody inside the condom. You could see the outline of the body and so on. And then it worked. And I think what happened when it didn't work was that people were spending a great deal of time trying to look through the condom to see Priscilla or to see whatever.
You want to describe the scene?
Describe the scene?
Yeah.
Well, we had this wonderful candlelit dinner, and eventually it's apparent to Priscilla the enormous attraction she has for me as I for her. And we stand up and the clothes literally fall off our bodies as she says, I believe in safe sex. And I say, so do I. And the next scene at the window in the bedroom, you see these shadowy images in an embrace. And you see these two giant condoms with the nipples on their heads as they maneuver and fall toward the bed.
Many of your fans may not realize that, A, you're from Canada, and B, your brother in Canada has been a member of parliament and, I believe, deputy prime minister as well?
That's true.
How far up north are you from?
Fort Norman is the place where I spent my childhood, and that is on the same parallel of latitude as Fairbanks in Alaska.
Brr.
It's pretty cold, you know. It gets 70 below zero.
So what kind of house did you live in?
Literally a log cabin. In many cases up in the north, you find log cabins like that with the sod roof and the mud and straw and manure kind of plaster that's put in between the cracks of the logs and to use as a sealer, I guess, for the cabin itself. And in many cases, there was never a floor in the cabins. There was just that heavy, hard-packed gumbo clay, which was like cement, actually, when it was properly tended to.
Now, I was surprised to read that you had also studied dance with Martha Graham when you went.
Well, it's part of the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Oh, I see.
They had Martha Graham was a friend of Mrs. Morgenthau, who I believe had founded the Playhouse, and so she was kind enough to teach us modern dance. I did not know who Martha Graham was.
You see, it just seems so out of character for me to think of all the airplane pilot and the cops that you've played, you know, doing modern dance with Martha Graham.
Well, I agree with you. I felt the same way. But the second year, it dawned on me, you know, who Martha Graham and dancing and so on. They had those kind of a blue jersey outfit they put on you with bell-bottom trousers and this was the kind of uniform you wore on any modern dance presentation. And, you know, I was used to cowboys and Indians and shoot 'em up and a Tarzan and swinging from the trees, not this, running across with the piano music and doing hoppity-hippity and skippity-scoppity and so on. But the second year, I buckled down and really tried very hard to learn modern dance and to be part of it. And I'm very grateful that I did, too.
So you got to really like it.
Yes, I did. But also, you know, to have the benefit of being taught by such an extraordinary artist as Martha Graham.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know about anything. So I had a lot of catching up to do.
Would you still like to do drama?
Sure. I do the one-man play, Darrow.
Oh, I didn't know.
The Life of Clarence Darrow, and I admire the man so much, and I love the play, and one day I will do it again. And also, one day down the line, I'd like to do Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. But, you know, the disclaimer is that I don't have any ambition, and I do not have any goals, so I may not do them.
That's refreshing.
Yeah, right. I'm happy. You know, I like people, and I like hanging out with the people I love, and that's the name of the game for me right now.
Leslie Nielsen recorded in 1993. He died yesterday at the age of 84.
I'm Lieutenant Frank Drebin, police squad. And don't ever let me catch you guys in America.
You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Actor Leslie Nielsen died yesterday at the age of 84. We're going to listen back to an interview with him. Nielsen started a new comedic phase of his career in 1980 with his role as the doctor in the disaster film parody Airplane.
You'd better tell the captain we've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now. Tell the captain I must speak to him.
Airplane was followed with starring roles in other film parodies, like the series of cop movie parodies The Naked Gun and the horror movie parodies Scary Movie, in which he played the president of the U.S. Earlier, he was in over 60 films playing a lot of straight-laced characters. In the real disaster film, The Poseidon Adventure, he played the ocean liner captain. His straight delivery was a plus for his role in Airplane.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Doctor, I've checked everyone. Mr. Stryker's the only one.
What flying experience have you had?
Oh, I flew single-engine fighters in the Air Force, but this plane has four engines. It's an entirely different kind of flying, altogether.
It's an entirely different kind of flying.
Besides, I haven't touched any kind of plane in 6 years.
Mr. Stryker, I know nothing about flying. There's one thing I do know. You're the only one on this plane who can possibly fly it. You're the only chance we've got.
I spoke with Leslie Nielsen in 1993 after the publication of his book, The Naked Truth, in which he told a totally made-up version of his life. Here's an excerpt of his audio version of the book.
I'm an extremely fortunate person. I've been honored by my colleagues with 4 Academy Award nominations. I've twice been named Best Actor. I've won 2 People's Choice Awards, a Golden Globe, a Best in Show at Westminster, an American League batting title. I've been a 3-time finalist in the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. I was named Mr. Week of April 23rd on Home Shopping Network. And finally, in August 1990, I received the highest honor any actor could be given, other than participation in gross receipts. I was awarded the coveted Nobel Prize for Good Acting.
You've become famous for lampooning square, mediocre actors in B-movie formulas.
Yeah, well, it's not really becoming famous for lampooning those kind of actors. I'm really lampooning myself, and I'm pretty square. And I'm pretty dumb, and I'm pretty stupid, too.
Well, this all started for you with Airplane. How were you chosen as one of the actors in Airplane?
I think that David and Jerry Zucker and Jim Abrams, who were the authors and the creators, directors, etc. of Airplane, they had written something that was just wonderfully dumb and funny. And they knew that if Peter Graves and Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack and myself, they had seen our work on television, and if we approached their material with the same seriousness and the same gravity with which we approached our police work television show that we were doing, that it would be very funny. And when I read the script, I knew exactly what they were after, and it was the greatest, advent or break of my life in a sense, but I ended up working with people who spotted me for being the closet comedian that I was. And from there came Police Squad and Naked Gun, and it was the launching of the nut that is inside of Nielsen. Thank God for it.
How did you do the condom scene in Naked Gun?
Very gently. You know what happened with that scene was that in the beginning we had a material on the condom that you could, you know, really kind of see through. And the scene didn't work. It just didn't. It was not funny. And eventually David figured it out, and he had them remake the condom, but so that you could see the outline, but you could not see anybody inside the condom. You could see the outline of the body and so on. And then it worked. And I think what happened when it didn't work was that people were spending a great deal of time trying to look through the condom to see Priscilla or to see whatever.
You want to describe the scene?
Describe the scene?
Yeah.
Well, we have this wonderful candlelit dinner, and eventually it's apparent to Priscilla the enormous attraction she has for me as I for her. And we stand up and the clothes literally fall off our bodies as she says, I believe in safe sex. And I say, so do I. And the next scene at the window in the bedroom, you see this shadowy, these shadowy images in an embrace. And you see these two giant condoms with the nipples on their heads as they maneuver and fall toward the bed.
Many of your fans may not realize that, A, you're from Canada, and B, your brother in Canada has been a member of parliament and, I believe, deputy prime minister as well.
That's true.
And, how far up north are you from?
Fort Norman is the place where I spent my childhood, and that is on the same parallel of latitude as Fairbanks in Alaska.
Brr.
It's pretty cold, you know. It gets 70 below zero.
So what kind of house did you live in?
Literally a log cabin. In many cases up in the north, you find log cabins like that with the sod roof and the mud and straw and manure kind of plaster that's put in between the cracks of the logs and to use as a sealer, I guess, for the cabin itself. And in many cases, there was never a floor in the cabins. There was just that heavy, hard-packed gumbo clay, which was like cement, actually, when it was properly tended to.
Now, I was surprised to read that you had also studied dance with Martha Graham when you went
to Well, it's part of the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Oh, I see.
They had Martha Graham was a friend of Mrs. Morgenthau, who I believe had founded the Playhouse, and so she was kind enough to teach us modern dance. I did not know who Martha Graham was.
You see, it just seems so out of character for me to think of all the airplane pilot and the cops that you've played, you know, doing modern dance with Martha Graham.
Well, I agree with you. I felt the same way. But the second year, it dawned on me, you know, who Martha Graham and dancing and so on. They had those kind of a blue jersey outfit they put on you with bell-bottom trousers and. And this was the kind of uniform you wore on any modern dance presentation. And, you know, I was used to cowboys and Indians and shoot 'em up and Tarzan and swinging from the trees, not this, running across with the piano music and doing hoppity-hippity and skippity-scoppity and so on. But the second year, I buckled down and really tried very hard to learn modern dance and to be part of it. And I'm very grateful that I did, too.
So you got to really like it.
Yes, I did. But also, you know, to have the benefit of being taught by such an extraordinary artist as Martha Graham.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know about anything. So I had a lot of catching up to do.
Would you still like to do drama?
Sure. I do the one-man play, Darrow.
Oh, I didn't
realize The Life of Clarence Darrow, and I admire the man so much, and I love the play, and one day I will do it again. And also, one day down the line, I'd like to do Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. But, you know, the disclaimer is that I don't have any ambition, and I do not have any goals, so I may not do them.
That's refreshing.
Yeah, right. I'm happy. You know, I like people, and I like hanging out with the people I love, and that's the name of the game for me right now.
Leslie Nielsen recorded in 1993. He died yesterday at the age of 84.
I'm Lieutenant Frank Drebin, police squad. And don't ever let me catch you guys in America.
You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
past Sunday, the public got its first look at Broadway's long-anticipated musical take on Spider-Man. The show has an incredible pedigree, written and directed by The Lion King's Julie Taymor, with a score by U2's Bono and The Edge. But Sunday's preview did not go well. Judgment was harsh and, thanks to the internet, swift. Spider-Man officially opens January 11th, but as Jeff London reports, it's tough being a high-profile work in progress in the internet age.
The tweet started just before the curtain rose, 24 minutes late, on the first preview of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, and continued during the show. Quote, Spider-Man musical preview, glitch stop show mid-first act, actress suspended above stage for 5 minutes now, unquote. And for the next several hours during the show, which stopped four more times for technical difficulties, and the next day, on blogs and in newspapers, Spider-Man was sliced, diced, dissected, and declared dead on arrival, all on the basis of its very first public showing. Veteran producer Manny Eisenberg is mystified.
This is sort of like vultures sitting on a tree. These people did not start out to be embarrassed or to do an embarrassing show. And Julie Taymor is a heavyweight director. So why everybody is rooting for this failure in some perverse way is somewhat unbecoming, I would think.
A show's preview period is a time to work out the kinks in front of an audience, to tighten and clarify the storytelling, sometimes adding or cutting songs, to tame the technological complexities and make everything run smoothly. But Manny Eisenberg says the internet means people can post their reactions immediately.
The show is not going out of town for previews and off for a tune-up. And it's so high profile that that first performance is the opening night, whether they like it or not.
Spider-Man is under such intense scrutiny for many reasons, not the least of which is its budget-busting $65 million price tag, the highest in Broadway history, more than twice the cost of Shrek 2 years ago, says Bloomberg News Theater reporter Jeremy Girard.
The stakes on Spider-Man are so much higher and so much more in line with Las Vegas than Broadway, that's why everybody's really interested in it. This show is going to cost $1 million a week to run. That's twice as much as any other Broadway show.
Spider-Man's problems have been well documented, from the death of its founding producer to financial difficulties causing delays for a year to actors getting injured practicing some of the show's ambitious high-tech flying stunts. And until it was unveiled on Sunday evening, nobody really knew what the show was or was trying to be. A week and a half before previews began, U2 songwriter The Edge tried to explain.
It's been impossible to find a way to describe what this thing is, because it's not straight musical theater, it's not rock and roll, it's not opera, and it's not circus, but it is elements of all of those things. So we, in many ways, are kind of doing something that is highly ambitious and unprecedented.
And his writing partner, Bono, acknowledged even before preview started that the technical challenges of the show were making progress slow and difficult.
In fact, when the previews come on, I wouldn't be surprised there'll be lots of stopping and starting. I know that's allowed, but in the days of the internet, there'll probably be a lot of snickering.
So now, Bono, The Edge, and Julie Taymor are working under the microscope for the next 7 weeks to get their show as right as can be. Spider-Man has its second Broadway preview tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
You can fly too high and get too close to the sun. See how the boy falls from the sky.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Sanrio, the Japanese company that defines cute, is 50 years old. Its products include Hello Kitty. NPR's Madeline Del Barco reports that a new generation of artists is reinterpreting Sanrio's images.
There's just something about the simple yet classic Hello Kitty.
Meow!
Just ask 5-year-old Cece Cortez about the sweet cartoon character, a Japanese bobtail cat who loves baking cookies and was a UNICEF ambassador.
She has bows in her hair, she wears cute clothes, and she has cute little whiskers. She doesn't have a mouth.
She can't talk to you.
Meow, meow, meow.
Hello Kitty is the most recognizable of Sanrio's marketing sensations. Since 1974, her image has adorned everything from small plastic coin purses and pencils to toaster ovens and TVs, with the sunny philosophy that small gifts create big smiles. But she's not just for young girls. There's now official Hello Kitty motor oil, Hello Kitty wine, a Hello Kitty smart car, and even a Hello Kitty adult toy.
It's a little battery-operated thing. It's a personal massager. And they see it as a very innocent product meant for, you know, tired muscles and elbows and shoulders and stuff.
New York Times writer Ken Belson is author of a book about Hello Kitty's global brand. He says Sanrio has lasted for half a century with a winning formula, getting generations hooked on cute, even while unintentionally creating kitsch.
Because it's so pure, it's become sort of sickly and a kind of a pendant of mass consumerism that people have come to hate. That's not something the company would ever want to admit or even promote, but it's taken on a second life of its own, and actually 9 extra lives.
In 1960, Japanese World War II survivor Shintaro Tsuji started Sanrio, first to sell silk and beach sandals. Now the company hosts 2 theme parks and rakes in about $50 billion a year, thanks in part to its unique collaborations. That includes fashion designers and artists. In Los Angeles, Sanrio celebrated its 50th anniversary with a Kitty in Pink retro 80s prom party, a carnival, and an art exhibition.
Hello Kitty, as well as all the Sanrio characters, have almost been muses for the artists.
Janet Sue, the president of Sanrio Incorporated, shows us paintings, knitted artwork, and a jelly bean mosaic. One installation, called the Hello Kitty Fight Club, features a sculpted kitty with a black eye and a broken paw.
Here we have Hello Kitty. Looks like she's bleeding pink from her head.
Yeah, you see little splatterings of blood. Our characters are very zen-like, and they're pretty much canvases for everyone to interpret, whether it's a fan, whether it's an artist.
Cartoonist and designer Paul Frank, best known for his character Julius the Monkey, paid homage to Sanrio's frog Caropi in vinyl.
It just makes you happy.
Frank says he and his wife love Sanrio so much, they have a Hello Kitty baby grand piano at home.
I remember in the 70s, my mom would take my sister and I to the Sanrio store, and I remember just sniffing erasers.
Costume designer Jason Alpert has outfitted the outrageous characters Ali G, Borat, and Bruno. And for Sanrio's anniversary, he painted a mock-up of a masterpiece.
I've recreated the Last Supper, replacing Jesus and his disciples with my favorite Hello Kitty characters. I've called it Pass the Ketchup. It just looked like just more fun. And, you know, the whole thing is, Hello Kitty is fun.
Jason Alpert's Last Supper will be on display with other artistic Sanrio renderings at the prestigious Art Basel show in Miami this weekend. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.